When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're going to start with One Love.
One Love.
Jesus, how high. One heart.
Let's get together and feel all right.
I love that you just changed the octave.
Reggae is the people music.
You know you're a superstar.
I am a superstar. You can't separate the music and the message. You see, reggae music come to unify the people.
Not everyone likes what you're saying. For your own safety, you need to stop.
And welcome to episode 385 of the Filmmakers Podcast. This is a podcast where we talk
singing.
Please, from, no.
From indie sings to studio sings and every sing in between.
How to get them made, how to make them, and how to try not to
royally mess that octave up.
In our very, very humble opinion. If you're listening to for the first time, I'm really sorry. We are filmmakers, and we're here to talk about
Pod Marley.
Pod Marley, very good. We are here to talk with director Reinaldo Marcus Green this week. He's the director, if you haven't guessed by now, Bob Marley, One Love, the latest feature film, which is out now, starring Kingsley Ben-Adir. Oh, yeah. So Dom sat down with Reinaldo. What are our gorgeous listeners going to learn from this special Friday episode?
We talked about the freedom that having a hit with King Richard gave him as a director. We discussed bringing HODs from project to project, shooting in multiple countries, the difficulty of casting Bob Marley himself, big set pieces with crowds, and the positive push-pull collaboration with Paramount.
Ooh. That sounds super interesting. I've not listened yet. Toby is editing this week's episode for you, wonderful listeners. So I'm looking forward to listening later. It sounds like it's a really, really interesting episode. I haven't seen the film yet either, and I can't wait. This seems like it's right up my street. What is the film about, Dom?
It's about Bob Marley.
Excellent. Good. Go see it. What more do you need than that?
It's a very in-depth look at his life from a pivotal moment in Jamaica with turmoil in the government and his own kind of rise to superstardom, and then also an exploration in his roots and childhood, and also his partnership is a big thing. His relationship is a really fascinating part, which is a story which maybe you haven't heard as much beforehand. And it's a very honest look at some of his struggles and what he was trying to achieve. And it's a very multifaceted biopic.
There you go. It is written by Terrence Winter, Frankie Flowers, Zach Bailey, and Reinaldo Marcus Green. And it's produced by Dee Dee Gardner, Jeremy Kleiner, Sidala Marley, and Rita Marley, as well as Ziggy Marley, and exec produced by Brad Pitt. Cinematographer is Robert Elswit. And it was cast by Kareem Blake Chin, A.V. Kaufman, and our very own Carmel Cochrane. So, this film not only stars Kingsley Ben-Adir, who you will know from Peaky Blinders, High Fidelity, The OA, but most recently in Barbie as one of the Kens, but also One Night in Miami as Malcolm X, which definitely put him on the map for a lot of people. The movie also stars Lashana Lynch, James Norton, Tosin Cole, and Michael Gandolfini. Yeah, and the movie's out now in cinemas. Go and watch it. If you don't know, Reinaldo Marcus Green, as Dom has said, did direct King Richard, which starred Will Smith. He also directed and wrote Monsters and Men. He also directed, produced, and exec produced 6 episodes of We Own This City TV series, as well as co-exec produced and directed Top Boy in the UK.
Well, there we go. It was a really interesting chat because we went very much into the studio relationship, which is quite interesting, really, because a lot of people, they have very set ideas about what that means. Maybe it's an overbearing like massive power that's sort of telling you what to do, and then you've got the sort of indulgent filmmaker, and the reality is actually, you know, with a good studio and a good collaboration, there's a lot of, you know, in this one especially, there was some really interesting moments where, you know, he had to prove himself a little bit as a director, and then, you know, then he'd get given more leeway, and it was kind of, you know, it's actually being smart with money, and it's not giving too much too soon, and it's giving that extra bit when you need it, and when you've kind of shown results, and it actually seems like a very healthy collaboration.
I think that's very interesting. It's something that a lot of indie filmmakers don't often get the chance to do, and you're right, we think it's this big beast and they're there controlling everything, you know, but that's not necessarily always the case. So it's always interesting to hear it from people who've been there and done it, and what they prefer, and often they prefer being in the weeds and just getting stuff made without the big studio interferences sometimes. So it does depend. But yeah, however you can make your film, you make it, right? And if it's an easy way to raise money or get money for your film through a studio, well, of course you're going to do that, because it's really difficult.
And I suppose it's also how you approach the studio and what you ask for and at what point. And I suppose it's a sort of, you know, when you hear stories of like, oh, the director, you know, got booted off a project, or they didn't get you know, to do their vision. And you think like, yes, well, you know, how were they approaching it? Were they asking for everything on a platter at the start, and this sort of unlimited, you know, piece of string, or you know, was it a different story? So it's nice to sort of get another perspective on that question.
Yeah, totally agree. So all that's coming up for you with Dom and Ronaldo Marcus Green. Thank you so much for listening. You are amazing. Thank you for listening to last week's episode, if you did. Nikolai Arcel talking about The Promised Land, that's still in cinemas. Do go support. And obviously Michelle Franco, Memory, is out in cinemas now as well. Dom did that the week before. Coming up for you on Tuesday is Issa Lopez and talking about
True Detective Night Country.
Woohoo! Yes. The smash hit TV series with Jodie Foster. Dom goes deep into TV territory. So that is for you on Tuesday. Right, let's get to it. This is Dom talking with Ronaldo Marcus Green.
Great. Well, grab the microphone. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you.
Welcome to the Filmmakers Podcast, Ronaldo. So, I mean, how are you feeling with the buzz and the excitement and the release?
I feel content, man. Content in my heart. You know, we put it all out on the field, so to speak. And, you know, that's all I can ask for of myself and my cast and crew. I know they gave me everything that they had. So I feel very great about that. The family loves the film, and that's who we made it for. So I feel content.
Do you have a process for sort of dealing with the release and all the reviews, and do you tend to like what look at everything, or do you just, you know, no, it's out I there now?
To be,
but, you know.
I ask to be taken off the brakes and all that stuff. It's hard because it's like having a child in a lot of ways. And, you know, I've been living with this for 3 years, and, you know, and you spend nights and weekends and sleepless nights and all that stuff, and you put your body through the ringer and health and all that stuff. And, but it doesn't matter, right? My mom wants to go to the theater and say, is it good or is it bad? Like it's not about, you know, for us, it's about the process. But, so I'm getting better at just like trying to enjoy the journey. And, but it's hard to not think about it. Of course, you want people to love the film. And so I wink or I peek, but I certainly try to stay out of the fray. I'm not on social media. I don't have any accounts. I don't even have LinkedIn. So no social media. I'm not on it. I won't be looking. And hopefully I'll just feel the essence of the power of the film, Bob's words, his lyrics, his legacy, and know that we did something right.
Well, that's it. Cause, I mean, it's a lovely message, and it's such an important story as well. And I think that's the thing that, you know, that's the reward for going through all the struggle is knowing that you've made something that's sort of profound and is out there.
For sure.
So let's talk about how this came to you. Like, what was the first genesis of the project? Like, how did you hear about it for the first time?
Yeah, I remember I was in the edit for King Richard, and I got this script in my inbox from a producer I didn't know, Bob Tidal, and it was, yeah, it was the first script was written by Terrence Winter and Frankie Flowers, and even before I opened it, I was like, oh, it's a film about Bob Marley. I don't know if I should even read this until I need some answers. I need some clarity. Like, do they have the rights to the music? Is the family involved? And I needed to know those two things. And sure enough, on my first call, Ziggy Marley was on that call. And I said, oh, it must be real. That's definitely his son. And they had the rights to the music. And so I said, okay, wow. Like, I'd heard or read somewhere that, you know, they have been trying to make this movie for over 25 years. I heard Oliver Stone. I heard Scorsese. I heard big time names. And I was like, well, if they couldn't make it, like, what happened? You know, what got in the way? And but it really wasn't up to me to find out. It was up to me to say, all right, well, what can I do with it? And I felt like a gift that kind of fell on my lap a little bit. And I knew right away, you know, I read the script and look, it was a good foundation, but it wasn't there. And I knew we needed to put some elbow grease in there, so to speak. Mm. And part of that was bringing on Zach Bailyn, who had written King Richard for me. And so once I brought Zach on, I knew that we could help to crack the structure of the film. That was the thing that I was honestly most concerned about in the beginning stages, because we were never interested in doing it a cradle to grave, but it was like, there's so much about Bob's life, you know, what area to choose. And I think Zach was so brilliant with that, with his script with King Richard. And I thought, yeah, this was the exact thing that I needed to take this film to the next level.
Just before we move on to the structure, because that is a really important thing to discuss. What was that initial conversation with Ziggy? Like, what did that involve? What was he expecting from, you know, the story? What were the things that, you know, wanted to be in the film? Like those kind of things?
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, Ziggy, you know, he's obviously a musician, a very talented musician in his own right. And, you know, so when he was a producer on the film, so he was in part responsible for, you know, hiring me as the director of the film, but he loves movies, so he had seen tons of films. So it was kind of amazing because he had referenced a short film that I made, this short film that I made called Stone Cars in film school. And I was like, wait, you don't want to talk about King Richard? You want to talk about this short film that I made in South Africa? That's and it great. Was kind of yeah. incredible because I made that film essentially with no money. I mean, it was no lights, you know, kind of documentary style type filming. And he loved it. He loved the short. And I knew right away we were aligned with the type of movie that I think I was trying to make. I was always a little skeptical because it was like, I'm not necessarily a musical biopic person. It's not the kind of films that I watch per se or ever thought I would make. Although I did see Bohemian Rhapsody and I saw Elvis and I saw all those movies, and they're great. But that's just not something I thought I would make. And then here Bob comes along and I'm like, whoa, well, there's an opportunity here to do something a little different. I don't have to make your traditional biopic. I can do something, maybe come through the side door, not the front door. There's another way to look at this. So I was thinking about films like City of God and Amoros Perros and Black Orpheus.
The drama side, basically.
Yeah. And how do we pull out the humanity of this film? How do we go to the man, not just the, you know, how do we go to the man that's on all the buttons and t-shirts and bags?
Beyond the myth side of things.
Exactly. So that was definitely the first conversation. So I knew from there that we were aligned. And, you know, I think there was this unspoken thing about the language in the film. You know, I was always leaning towards, you know, like real patois in the film. I wasn't going to make the Cool Runnings version of the film, as much as I love that movie. Yeah. I love that film. I really do. Yeah. It was like a staple in my house. That wasn't this.
So structure. Because I mean, with a biopic, there's so many start points. You've got someone's whole life. There's obviously a lot of ways that things have been done in the past. There's so many elements that you could go for the B story and that side of things. Like, where did you start, and how did that conversation come about, and where did it lead from what was in the original sort of script that you first saw?
Yeah, I think, you know, the original script kind of leaned into a lot more of the Wailers and to their, you know, sort of childhood upbringing, discovery of music, which is great. I mean, honestly, it's some of the most fun stuff. So, you know, they did an amazing job. It just, it just didn't, our movie couldn't bear it. Our film couldn't bear it, not given where the A story was starting in 1976. And otherwise it would be a 4 or 5 hour movie. And so as much as I love those elements, which we retained a little bit of it, it wasn't what this movie was about. And it would take another movie or a series to do that. And why not? They have the rights forever. So yeah. Maybe there will be another Bob Marley movie or series at some point. But
the Wailers, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And this was about Bob Marley, Bob Marley's message, Bob Marley's legacy about the man. And we felt that there was a natural inherent structure starting in 1976. We know what happened to Bob, the assassination attempt on his life, on Rita's life, on his family. The displacement of that, having to leave Jamaica. And what did Bob do? He doubled down and he created Exodus, which is the album we all know, arguably the greatest album of the 20th century. So it just felt like a rich period of musical career. She also created Kaya during that time, which we couldn't go into in that way. But, you know, the album that we all know, the lyrics that we all know, and then his ultimate return to Jamaica for the One Love Peace concert, that felt like there was just a natural structure there.
Yeah, because I suppose you're starting in conflicts, you're hitting the ground running, and then you're kind of getting to the resolution by the end of the film.
That's exactly it. And then it was, okay, well, if we're starting there and we're ending there, then we know we're generally what our music is going to be in the film. It was sort of writing itself in a lot of ways. And then, you know, we had this other element of visions and we did have flashbacks. So it was, how do we integrate all these things without confusing the audience, making it seamless, making it feel like when we do flashback, that we're getting something that is relevant to be away from your star, you know, at the moment. And it's always tricky when you do that. So I think we landed in the right place. There are things obviously that fell on the cutting room floor, which we won't talk about, but certainly, I think we found the right pieces for our puzzle. And again, it's our puzzle. It's our version of the story that we thought we can tell without taking on too much or biting off too much.
Yeah, sure. So, one of the things I really liked about the film is my experience of Bob Marley is the music. And it's a very like glowing kind of outside image. I didn't really like, you know, when I was younger, to research who he was too much. This film really goes into the complexities of his relationship. It doesn't just show him as this kind of, you know, ambassador and pioneer. Obviously, it has that element, which is incredibly important, but it goes into the challenges he faced with his relationships and his life, which I thought was really fascinating and quite a brave decision. Was that in the original script? Was that part of your sort of input? Like, how did that sort of element of his character sort of come to be?
Yeah, no, that definitely got developed and strengthened over the course. Rita was not quite the character in the early drafts, and it just felt like a missed opportunity. I got the opportunity to read her book, and having come off of King Richard and realizing that the original drafts, even with that, didn't represent Orisine Price the right way. Mm. And that felt like a missed opportunity. And so I knew that we had this sort of like, you know, this golden ticket here. We had this because it was part of the story we didn't know about Bob. And that's what makes it interesting when you go to the theater. That's what makes it not a documentary. That's what makes it real. That brings you closer to the man because Rita Marley was the matriarch of his family, especially during that time. And not only that, but she was a band member. So she was in the room when they were making music. She was on tour and she was taking care of the kids. It's like, oh, wait, this like her story is so complicated and so unique.
And it feels as much her story as it is his as well, which is another great thing about the film is like you get this rounded experience of it, not just from his perspective.
Exactly. And then look, you add Lashana Lynch to that equation and you have just this dynamic, rich performance. She's able to elevate every scene that she's in. She's able to take my not so great writing and make it better. She's just able to, you know, she's able to lift those moments because she's demanded excellence. And her and Kingsley together, they're so dynamic. They jump off the screen. You know, hopefully my filmmaking style allows them to breathe, allows them to go to places that we're a fly on the wall. Let's find it. Let's elevate this. Let's dig. And they bring it. They bring it together. Truly.
So how did you go through that process of casting? Were there the obvious choices from the start?
No, nothing was obvious.
Nothing was obvious.
Nothing,
okay.
Not with Bob.
Because it seems it now, but I mean, I imagine it was quite a difficult sort of casting.
Well, I didn't know Kingsley Benadire. I didn't know him at all. And so, you know, I'd looked at, I want to say thousands of tapes for over a year. And quite honestly, I think we were running to the end of the road because I think the rights were coming to the end. And I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure I was going to find my Bob. I hadn't found my Bob for sure. And I thought, well, I guess I can't make the movie. I can't destroy this film by not, you know, by just casting anybody. And then lo and behold, you know, Kingsley's tape showed up and it really had me leaning in. He had the it factor. And, you know, it was like, it was so different than everything else I had seen. It was moons above that. And obviously you see how talented he is and you see what he can bring. And I saw that. I saw the glimmer of hope that it was possible because he didn't try to mimic Bob. It was a real interpretation and it was unique, you know, even where he placed the camera, it was three quarters. He didn't do a flat on. He didn't have three cameras and cut, you know, he didn't do any of that. He kept it simple, his accent. And I'm not a native, you know, patois speaker, but it could have fooled me. So his baseline was incredible. So I thought, okay, this guy definitely has what it takes to get there. Now I need to meet him and see what he's all about. And from that moment, that was the start. And and then he went on a complete transformation.
What was that initial conversation when you met?
It was more about feeling him. I don't remember exactly what was said. Clearly he was interested because he had given the tape. Yeah, I think it was just me being in his presence and seeing if I felt the same thing I felt when I was on the tape. And Kingsley's quite a, you know, he's quite big. And so when I met him, there's a gravitas to him. There's a poise, there's a confidence. There's a lion in there. And so I felt all of that. And I knew I had someone that was going to challenge me and challenge the film. You can sense that from his intelligence. He's not somebody you put in a box. He's not somebody he's not going to take the status quo. And when you're, I don't know, call it a football player, you want your players to have that ability to audible at the line, I guess, if things aren't right. You know, you're looking for players that are dynamic, that aren't going to stay between the X's and the O's, that they're going to improvise. They're going to elevate. And he just had the ability, and you're looking for somebody that has that kind of essence. And he had all those elements. And again, you know, for me, obviously I had to see him as Bob and, you know, the prosthetics and the hair and makeup. And I knew I could support him. And then obviously the singing and the dancing, all of that was secondary to me. I needed a great actor. And I knew that from King Richard. We didn't need tennis players. I was never going to find Venus and Serena. I needed to find great tennis players. I needed to find a great actor that could play a musician, because it's not just about fingering and plucking and dancing. It's about the person, the humanity, who Bob was. And the other stuff, yeah, of course, it is important, and you need to believe that. And a great actor was going to be able to do that. I mean, I think he was letting his fingers bleed, learning how to play the guitar. I mean, he really went in. So kudos to him. I mean, unbelievable performance. I'm so proud of him. I can't wait to see what he does next, but unbelievable performance.
Yeah, I think that's a really fascinating point that you sort of touched on about finding the essence of a character or a story rather than the, you know, copying the mannerisms. Because, you know, a lot of my favorite biopics, some of the things aren't exactly how they were, but the person has interpreted what they stood for. And that to me is like what you need to hook into, because really it's about feeling what the person has been trying to achieve, and that has to be done on an emotional level.
Absolutely. And I think it comes from the storytelling and supporting the story with what it needs. And I think that's part of the, you know, the magic of making movies is trying to allow your actors to disappear into the roles. Never too big for what the film is, just right. You know, you want you want the film to be great. The performances are great in a great film. That's ultimately yes, what you're trying to achieve. And that's the mark of great filmmaking, is when those things all align. It's not just that one thing. It's the cinematography, it's the production design, it's the costume design, it's the score, it's the soundtrack, it's the performances, it's the direction. It's all of those things that should feel seamless when you're watching a movie and you just love it. You don't know what. And if obviously, look, there is LeBron James, and there's no doubt that, you know, or Michael Jordan, you know, Kingsley is our Michael Jordan. But you know, Michael Jordan needed Scottie Pippen. He needed Dennis Rodman. You know, they needed the coaches, they needed the staff, and ultimately, hopefully he felt supported. We needed Jamaica. Mm. We needed the spirituality of Bob. We needed the family. We had those things, not just myself. We were all supported. It was a tremendous collaborative effort in bringing this film together.
After you'd got, just jumping between the script and the casting and the sort of the making of the film, at what point did the studio Paramount get involved? And was it like a simple process from, okay, I'd like to make this, to it being greenlit and, you know, given the options to who you need to cast? Or what was the struggles in that period?
Yeah, the struggles for me, I mean, so Paramount had already had the rights with the family even during my first call. So Paramount obviously was involved in hiring me as the director.
But
the movie was not greenlit. It was greenlit verbally. This movie's happening, sure. Right? Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I certainly wasn't getting paid.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. So yeah, I think the first step was really the development of the script. And so I did, you know, I think their timeline was a lot shorter than my timeline. Mm. And part of my initial pushback was, I'm not making this movie when you guys are saying we're going to make this movie, because it's unrealistic. There's too much work that needs to go into this right now. And so maybe I had a little bit of leverage at that moment in my career coming off of King Richard that I could get that extra 6 months to make sure that we at least got the skeleton to a place that I felt was good. And we did. We utilized that time. So, we pushed back on the studio and they accepted it in the best way. But yeah, they stayed on us for the script and checking in every month. Where is it? Where is it? Where is it? Where is it? And until we found something that we felt comfortable sharing. And at that point, again, there was no money, but then there was notes.
Yes.
That's where the note process starts.
Okay,
and
yeah,
they had notes, and you know, they were good notes. I mean, it's a studio, right? You have to take notes from where they come from. You don't agree with all of them, but you
make it work for the story.
You make it work for the story. And so, yeah, probably for the next 6 months was implementing those series of notes that came in.
Yeah, sure.
So yeah, it was a better half of a year that we spent on that. And in the same process, we were starting to cast. And so, but I couldn't move on any of the cast, including LaShana, until we had Bob.
Yeah,
until I found Kingsley, there was no cast. And so once we had Kingsley, then the script became even more real. And the project became even more real. But yeah, as studios are, it's like a Titanic. It's not a speedboat that you can turn around.
But it's also, I like the fact that you did push back, and I like the fact that they were open to that, because, you know, sometimes stuff is shoved through and they're like, well, we're shooting at this point and it's not ready. And you know, whether it's, you know, the wrong cast or there's structural errors with the story, it's actually going to impact the film down the line anyway. So it's nice to be able to, you know, navigate those kind of waters and find a middle ground where they know they're in, you know, safe hands of someone that's thinking this through, and you know that you're not sort of being, you know, pushed into something before it's ready.
You know, for us, there are certain realities that you can't move, right? Like the Super Bowl is when the Super Bowl is.
Yeah, sure.
Like, and there are certain things you can't move. And then there are other things that are arbitrary. Mm. And you have to know which ones are which. Starting here, why? Like, there has to be a really good reason for starting here. We want the best version. If a better movie means moving it 2 weeks or 2 months, let's look at the reasons to doing that. Obviously, there are certain things that are cost prohibitive, and you have to play within certain boundaries. Like, I'm not, you know, I'm a player as well, right? Like, yeah, we have to be realistic. But then there are certain things that it's actually going to cost you more. It's going to save you money by us making a better movie. So that's always my pitch.
Yeah, great.
And it does. You know, when you have a good enough, strong enough pitch, then I think the studio does understand that. So I think it comes down to leadership, controlling the ball, making them see why it's of value so that it's not us versus them. They're making our movie and they're in support of that. And I've always felt like Paramount supported this film from day one. We were making a foreign language film with no subtitles. I mean, that's a daring thing for a studio to take on. I don't know if they knew quite that they were getting themselves into that, but they certainly knew enough.
Sure.
They knew enough to stay quiet unless it was a problem. And we never let it get into problem territory. I think we towed the line for a little while because it's not so easy. But I think I knew that we can dial it in a place that that felt like we could make it universal and people would lean into the authenticity of how we created the language in the film.
So just talking about like how, you know, the language, let's talk about the visual language, the art department, the costume, makeup, all those kind of departments. How was that was there a lot of studio sort of input? Okay, well, we've got these kind of people that work for this budget. Did you have a mix of your own sort of previous heads of departments?
Yeah, so for me, you know, fortunately I was coming off of King Richard and so I think
good people.
I had great people. And I think the studio knew that they were hiring the director of King Richard. So if you want King Richard level, you've got to give me King Richard level talent. And that started with Robert Elswick, who was my DP on King Richard, arguably one of the greatest cinematographers to ever do it. Also just one of my best friends. So it's great. We live around the corner from each other. I see him all the time. We looked after his little baby. But he's just amazing. He's an amazing filmmaker. And so Robert was my number one choice. Thankfully he was available and could do the film. And so, you know, they agreed to Robert coming on and helping me do that. And you know, what I love about Robert is that we rarely talk lenses or, you know, or any of that stuff. It's all about story, script. So our foundation for the visuals are always about what the movie is. And, you know, the way we block scenes, it's about the actors will help, you know, when I'm blocking a scene, it's not forcing an actor to sit into a certain area. We'll light once we've blocked the scene. So it's a very organic way of filming. There's not a lot of marks on the floor. I don't really do that. Sometimes you have to put a mark, but we really try not to. That's not the space that we like to work in. And the movie kind of, you know, the space tells you what the scene needs a little bit. And so, yes, Robert was number one, but I brought on a lot of my returning folks. Carla Farmer, who had done hair for King Richard, Pamela Martin, who was my editor on King Richard, Chris Bowers, who was my composer on King Richard. So yeah, I was like, you're going to get some craftsmanship. We definitely went with a new production designer because obviously period London was very different. So I think it was a value to have somebody that was here that understood what those spaces were. Chris Lowe did a phenomenal job. On this film. He had come from the Bond world. He was a big time art director for many, many years. And I was looking for somebody that needed a stretch role. Put him in something that he hadn't quite done before. And I think that's exciting. And he loved Bob. And he gave me a great pitch, a great visual presentation. And I felt very comfortable with him. And I also knew we had a lot of builds in this film. So I think his art director background, I think, was very helpful for us, and also somebody that can bring an edge of design. So Chris was a new addition to that team. And then obviously our costume design, Anna Shepherd, who had been nominated and won Schindler's List and lots of other great films. So amazing wealth of knowledge.
So do you tend to work visually in terms of how you put together these kind of heads of department early meetings? I mean, I imagine it starts with the script, but then after that, like, how do you tend to work?
Yeah, so, you know, I pull for every film. I always have my own sort of mood board, but I'm not a designer. So I'll like just dump a bunch of photos into a Google Drive.
Yeah. And can't go wrong with Google.
But I think if you click it, you get a palette, you get an understanding. Every single department head I sat down with, City of God was the first thing that came out of my mouth. Oh, I love that. I love that. So everybody was on board with, you say City of God, it says something else. It says raw, it says gritty, it says real. So I think there was just a tentpole. This is what we're trying to achieve cinematically. And so I think the conversation, how I talk about the film, how I talk about the type of movie that I want to make is through conversation. And I spent a lot of time, even in the interview process with my crew, talking about that, seeing if we're aligned with that, making sure that that they see the kind of film that I'm trying. They're also an extension of my eyes. They help me see things that I don't see. So I'm not looking for yes men and women. I'm looking for people that are going to challenge me. I think that makes us all better, and that goes in front of and behind the camera.
So for post-production on this, how did that go? I mean, had you shot everything that you needed? Was there anything that came out in the edit where you thought, okay, well, a few pickup days or so on would actually improve this idea that we've just sort of had? What was the sort of overall involvement in that process?
Yeah, well, look, in the production, we obviously had some budgetary constraints. And so there were just certain things that I knew we didn't get, in particular crowd shots. We had so much so many concerts to shoot that we couldn't get everything that we needed on the days that we had them, because it was all about the story, what was happening. We have a lot of storytelling happening in these concerts. We've got visions. We've got them coming off and on the stage. We've got backstage, and these are also your concert days. So in the script, it just reads, one love piece. It doesn't look like that much, but there's so much that goes into capturing that. And obviously dressing crowds, the Exodus tour montage is several days of shooting concerts and shooting transitions and shooting lighting setups. So I knew that there was more work to be done there, whether it was cutaways or finding the emotion there. So, I just thought if we built enough, then the studio might give me a little money to go get the rest.
So you sort of, the approach is, okay, well, I've proved myself with the film. Here's some really good stuff, but let's make it the best we can. And then you justify the pickups at that stage.
And look, every studio builds in a contingency for a reason. I used to think as a young filmmaker that doing a reshoot or an additional photography was like taboo. And now it's like, please, it's almost necessary. So much of the edit reveals itself, and you realize you can be so precise about what you need to pick up. We knew, like, when you cut a week out of the schedule before shooting, it's inevitable that you're going to need time to pick that back up. Now, you may not need all of it, but certainly need certain pieces. So yeah, there were close to 5 days that were cut out before we started shooting, and that's exactly what we got back. And so we got what we needed, and it was great to have the studio support. And we can be very, and it was great because we were more precise. Precise because we had the cut, we had the picture, and we can rewrite to exactly what we needed versus what we had in the early iterations of the script.
And it also seems like a really reasonable approach as well, because, I think a lot of people, they're like, well, the studio can give me as much money as I want. And, they're trying to be careful. They're trying to make sure that the relationship's going well as well. And it's a nice sort of way that you've gone backwards and forwards, and they've given you trust, and then you've shown some good stuff.
Absolutely. It's about building trust. And look, Paramount was so great in helping us achieve this movie. It's a complicated film. You're shooting in Jamaica. The infrastructure is not like that of London or the States. They do have a great film, community, but it's you have to fly a lot of things in. It's not quite what it is in those places. So you're dealing with elements, you're dealing with weather, you're dealing with challenges, you're dealing with crowds and people, and we're shooting on the streets of Trenchtown. So yeah, there are elements to the filmmaking process which could be very complicated, and Paramount was nothing short of amazing in supporting us there. And we never felt unsafe. We never felt like we didn't have the resources we needed to achieve. But yeah, it's a studio. It's like mom and dad. You can get, I'll give you $20 for this, but $0.50 for this or whatever it is.
If you do your homework, you can have the other 20.
you always want more. Who doesn't want more?
Yeah, sure.
Every kid wants more. You have to beg, pout, do whatever you need to get the money, and I'm sure I did many times, but I'm very grateful that they let me have what we needed.
So how do you get to like the, obviously you're making a great movie, you've got a studio on board, you've got great stars. How do you how did you start and get to this stage? Like, what, I mean, you obviously, you started in short films, and I saw you sort of worked into TV, and then you did the biopic, was it?
Yeah. So I've done, this is my fourth feature, and I've done three television shows so far. And I started,
We Own the City as well.
We Own the City was the last series that I did with John Bernthal, who's amazing. So yeah, I mean, look, I went to NYU Tisch Graduate Film School. I'd left my day job at AIG, the insurance company, and I was pursuing.
Did that just happen out of the blue? Like, I'm done. I want to make films.
No, well, it was actually my second career. So I first started as an elementary school teacher. I did that for a couple of years, then went to Wall Street. And I have a brother, Rashad Ernesto Green, that's a filmmaker. And so I was seeing him kind of fulfill his dreams. He was traveling the world on his art, and I just thought it was amazing. I had no interest in making films. I just had a brother that was doing it, and he started to invite me as his brother to help out on his film school sets, like as a glorified PA, wrangling cables, ordering lunch for people. And so I was introduced to film through my brother, and I just thought, you know, it was so cool to see him finally do that and live out some, and he was telling our own family stories. So I thought, oh, people care about that. That's cool. And so fast forward, I'm on Wall Street. I'm, you know, 26, 27 years old, and thinking like, what got me here? I'm not sure. Call it a quarter life crisis, and thinking, I don't know. I don't, if I die, I read this book. It was Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. And I think one of the chapters starts where you're like looking at your coffin. And I was like, whoa, if I died today, would I be happy? And I think the answer was no. And I was like, ooh, like I can't get caught out. Like, not that I was morbid, but I was just thinking like, I can't die like this. I can't die here on Wall Street staring at Excel spreadsheets. I got to do something else with my life. And so, yeah, that's when I decided to apply to film school, and I wanted to be a writer, producer, and help my brother make his films. And so I applied to NYU. I got waitlisted. Somehow I got in. I was the last kid accepted into my program, and then I started writing directing, because it's a writing directing program, and that changed the course of my life forever. Those short films, the one that I mentioned, Stone Cars, went to Cannes, and Telluride.
Okay, so you had the sort of festival success story that got you launched, basically.
It got me launched. I was making, making shorts for no money. And yeah, I mean, I was paying $50,000 a year to go to film school or more, but I certainly was making the shorts with nothing. And those shorts got out there. They got out there in a big way, afforded me the opportunity to make my first film, Monsters and Men. And once that happened, yeah, the career took off in a different way. And unusual. I didn't realize how fast it was going to go. Straight from there, I went right into Top Boy here in the UK. Yeah. Unbelievable opportunity working for Netflix and kicking off a series with Drake and all of that stuff.
So was that difficult going from film to TV and into the UK at the same time?
What was cool about it is that they were looking for a film director. And it was also the start. So I felt like I was making a mini film in some ways. I got to cast. I found Michael Ward, who's in this film.
Oh, yeah.
So it was cool. Yeah, everything's difficult, but it felt seamless. It felt seamless. I felt like they wanted a film director to put a vision to a series. And so all of my work, even in TV, I've been able to sort of have some creative control or creative influence, if you will, in starting series or being a part of that. And so, yeah, just kind of, it's like a little bit of a rocket ship from the first film.
Once you really got committed into it. Just a last bit of advice, if you could go back to maybe yourself struggling at one point, you're not sure if you're going to make it or you're waiting for that big break. What would you give yourself or a young filmmaker advice-wise?
Well, I think obviously it's you have to have a really deep trust in yourself. And you're going to hear no a lot. There's going to be a lot of people that tell you not to do it or, try something else. And you really have to stick to your guns and trust yourself. Trust yourself a lot, because I think there's just like a lot of people get paralyzed by how difficult it is. Writing's really hard. And I think it's okay to know that it's hard and force yourself to do something every day to move your project forward. And if you can't write for 5 hours, don't write for 5 hours, write for 5 minutes. But do something every day. Just do something every day towards your project. You have to move it forward. You have to continue to push. And if you love it, then, you know, it won't feel like work. It'll feel like something that you're, you know, that you were destined to do.
Amazing. Thank you, Ronaldo. That's a real pleasure. And best of luck with the film. Bob Marley, One Love. It's amazing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Pleasure.
There we have it. That was great. That was Dom chat with Ronaldo Marcus Green. Wow.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a really, really good chat. I mean, I think it's always great just to see how you approach a big movie, especially when there's like a huge amount of pressure with a real life, you know, persona like Bob Marley, and you know, how he put this together, how he took it sort of stride by stride, you know, working with the casting, the big set pieces. I mean, all of the nuances of what to show in his life. I think it was very, very well handled.
Yeah, and Kingsley seems like an absolutely fantastic lead.
Yes,
as well. I know he's way taller than Bob Marley was, but I don't think that shows. I don't think it matters. Certainly in the trailer I've seen, it's not made any difference at all. And I think when you go about casting people, it's what is right, what feels right.
Yes.
I imagine biopics are really difficult when you've got to match someone or their persona and how they're coming across. But here, I think Kingsley is brilliantly well cast.
Yes. And I think that was one of the things that we sort of went through was, you know, what level of, like, are we making a documentary? Are you going to approach and actually, like, are you just representing what they stood for and then, you know, sort of working within that energy? And I think that's always like a really important, you know, signpost in terms of like how to approach, you know, whether you're just copying the movements of someone or whether you're trying to embody what they stood for. And I think this one's good because it sort of does the latter. Yeah, and you know, it was nice to hear about, you know, obviously he had a lot of success with King Richard and then bringing HODs from that onto other projects. And, you know, I think that's a really good point. If you've got people that you like working with and you've got a shorthand, that's really valuable and it saves a lot of time on set as well.
Totally agree. And even if that's going from short to feature, people sometimes get a bit wary or scared of going, oh, well, can they handle it on a feature film? Well, yeah, there's always that question, but at the end of the day, if you get on with someone really well and you have a shorthand and you feel that connection on a short film, whatever department it is, doesn't have to be a DOP, it could be anything, any crew member, then bring them along for the ride. Bring them along, because that is more important than so many other things, is that connection and understanding of each other. And you'll get each other through it. You'll get each other through those hard times, and you'll be able to talk to each other when you're not happy about something, or you are happy about something, which you might not do if it's someone new, because you might be scared of their experience or how many films they've shot before. But if they're not doing it how you want it to be, then you're doing it wrong, right? So you might as well bring in the people that you want to. And I certainly did that with The Dare, bringing in Andrew Roger. He'd obviously made features before, but we'd only made shorts together. So I found that, you know, really important for me.
And you knew you had a beard you could trust.
Absolutely, because he does have a lovely beard.
So there we go.
So there we go. Speaking of which, his movie, No Way Up, is out in America now. So if you are in America, do go watch his shark movie. We call it a shark movie, but it's an aeroplane crashing into the sea and then gets attacked by sharks. It's ace. It's really fun. It's what it sounds like, but better. Cool. All right. Well, I hope you enjoyed that. Yeah. Thanks for those who popped down to the Ritzy last night in Brixton. Very lovely to see you all. For Matt and Tori Butler, Heart Dagger. Dom, it was great to see you there as well.
Yes, I was there.
Do go on IMDb and give it a lovely rating if you did. Support indie film. Support each other. And my documentary, Old Town Aren't We, that I produced, Jack Spring directed, is out on DVD now. So if you've got a DVD player still, you can get that from MarinersTV.com. It will be more news on that coming soon, but we just had our cinema run, which went very well. So more news coming soon. So we will see you Tuesday when we have
True Detective.
Yes, Issa Lopez, Dom chatting all about how she made that, wrote it, directed it, legend. So if you're lucky enough to make a film, if you're lucky enough to rise up and do well, it is your duty to
send the whale-evator down, back down.
Whale-evator? Whalers.
Yeah, wow. There we go.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll go with that.
We'll go with that. Okay, there we go.
Yeah, well done. Until next Tuesday, take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Cut. Could you be love? No, dumb, no cry. No. One love. No. One love.
One heart.
Let's get together and feel alright.
Alright.
Let's get together and make lots of films.
That's cringeworthy.
That's enough.
Don't put that last one in.
No, definitely. Stop recording.
Okay, yeah. That was a cringy end.